Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 92. It's Monday, December 14th. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. And before we get to the usual COVID-19 news, which seems to dominate public health news these days, I'd like to do a follow-up on a story I did last week. I did a story about the FDA's ability to regulate tobacco products, specifically controlling the nicotine content. And with a stroke of a pen, the FDA, a Joe Biden administration, could actually reduce nicotine and tobacco products down to a non-addictive level. And they estimate that this would bring tobacco use from 15% among adults in the U.S. down to 1%. And of course, the addiction thing keeps people going, but also it's what gets people started. Over 90% of people who are tobacco users begin as adolescents. And without the addictive potential, people are unlikely to pick up such a nasty habit. Well, the specific follow-up I'd like to add to reporting on that last week is that, you know, there's a lot of contention about what can be done, like with executive order versus, you know, whether the Democrats control the Senate and all this kind of stuff. And of course, progressives are disappointed because Joe Biden has said, you know, he would veto even something like if you were able to get something like Medicare for all. So I just wanted to kind of juxtapose those two things, meaning basically eliminating tobacco use in this country versus, say, Medicare for all, a popular progressive touchstone, which, of course, is a huge thing and would save lots of lives and improve the quality of life and certainly the ease of dealing with healthcare, which is pretty much a nightmare proportions these days. But here's what I like to posit. This is a really good example of the difference between public health and medical care. Okay, we know in documenting the great 10, if you look at the 20th century, 1900 to 1999, if you look at the amount of lifespan that was actually increased due to medical care, it was 10%. Virtually all of it was due to public health. Now, in that century, sanitation, antibiotics, improved nutrition, those were all things that contributed greatly to improving our length and quality of life. Okay, so my contention basically is this, is that if you eliminate tobacco use essentially in this country, you would eliminate about 500,000 preventable deaths a year. That is likely way more than the amount of deaths you would prevent by moving from our current healthcare system to a wondrous single-payer healthcare system. And the fact is, it wouldn't cost a net penny for the federal government to do that. Now, of course, you would lose tobacco taxes, but you would also save tons on Medicare and Medicaid by having reduced morbidity and mortality due to tobacco use. Now, of course, people would live longer, so you would have to pay more Social Security, I suppose. But like Will Rogers said, despite the high cost of living, it's still quite popular. Okay, well, back to COVID-19 news. As the U.S. tops 300,000 COVID-19 deaths, coincidentally, this happened on the same day that COVID-19 vaccinations begin. And I like to start off with a short article that sort of sums up where we're at. This from The Hill. U.S. enters brutal stretch of pandemic, even with approaching vaccines. The United States is entering an even more brutal stretch of the pandemic, with deaths now exceeding 3,000 people every day. But there is light at the end of the tunnel from a vaccine. The promise of a vaccine sets up a diverging reality, where in the short term the pandemic is getting even worse, but there is reassurance that it will not last forever. Public health experts are therefore urging the public to double down on precautions to get through the toughest phase for a few months until the vaccine is widely available. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Robert Redfield issued a stark warning about the coming weeks. We are in the time frame now that probably for the next 60 to 90 days, we're going to have more deaths per day than we had at 9/11 or we had at Pearl Harbor, Redfield said. The U.S. is at record-breaking levels of more than 200,000 new cases every day and more than 100,000 people in the hospital. And the situation is only getting worse, especially as the surge from Thanksgiving gatherings starts to show up. Despite the worsening crisis, President Trump has largely been silent on the spread of the coronavirus, except to tout progress on a vaccine. He has not consistently urged the public to take precautions in the short term or announced major new steps to slow the spread until a vaccine is widely available. Governors have also had a fractured response, with some announcing new measures even as others largely resist restrictions amid the surge. Only 15 states have closed bars, for example, one of the main sources of spread of the virus. I'm going to say that again. Only 15 states have closed bars, one of the main sources of spread of the virus. As I've commented on before, the fact that we close down schools and keep bars open is a stunning indictment of the mismatch of priorities. And there's a lot that goes behind that, but that's where we're at. Only 15 states. Of course, we need to support businesses, including bars, that are closed due to the necessity of a pandemic, but that's where we're at right now. Okay, Congress has been deadlocked for months on additional economic aid, which could help these businesses financially while they close for public health reasons. Experts are urging the public to step up precautions like wearing a mask and avoiding indoor gatherings, even in private homes if people from multiple households are mixing together. The CDC has encouraged people not to travel for the holidays this month as well, given that travel is likely to lead to a further spike. This is going to be, I think, a brutal time for us, Redfield said. As I said, I think it will be the most challenging time in the history of our nation from a public health perspective. And I want the public to really understand that despite what I said, that's not written in stone if people really would embrace the strategies that we've asked. He added, people should not let their guard down just because they're around family members who come to celebrate a holiday. The first people are likely to start getting vaccinated within days, starting with healthcare workers and people in nursing homes. Officials project 20 million people will be vaccinated in December, but the majority of the public will not have access to the vaccine for several months, likely sometime in the spring. The fact is, vaccines are not going to have a public health impact for at least several months, Anthony Fauci, the government's top infectious disease expert, said on a webcast hosted by the Journal of the American Medical Association. While some individuals will be protected starting this month, vaccinations will not be widespread enough to significantly slow the spread of the virus for several months. A rising problem is that as the pandemic gets worse, hospital capacity is being stretched to the breaking point, threatening the quality of care that patients are able to receive. We are short of ICU beds, said Janice Orlowski, chief healthcare officer for the Association of American Medical Colleges, which represents academic medical centers around the country. I think that we really have to see that we can see what we can do to dampen the travel and to really drive home the point that we can't have a repeat of Thanksgiving, she added. Some states have moved to significantly tighten restrictions amid the surge. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, Democrat, issued a three-week pause that includes banning indoor dining and restricting indoor gatherings to no more than 10 people. But the U.S. response remains divided, and many states have not taken such steps. Ashish Jha, dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, pointed to the partial lockdowns that the UK, France, and Germany imposed at the end of October as having turned around their trajectories, in contrast to the US, where new cases are still rising. At one point, both UK and France had more cases per capita than we did, he tweeted. But the big three European nations put in policies to bring the virus under control, and it's working. And we haven't, and it shows. Hospital capacity is an increasing concern as it is unclear how much worse the pandemic will get. We are seeing an unfolding disaster, said Yonatan Grad, an infectious disease expert at the Harvard School of Public Health. We're seeing incredibly high rates of transmission. We're seeing increasing hospitalization. We're seeing increasing ICU bed occupancy, and in many places are running up against the limits of the resources they have available to care for people. I think it's challenging in the extreme right now, and it's going to get worse.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's get to the local COVID-19 update. Well, last week when I reported the number of cases, we actually saw a decrease in the number of identified infections. And as I postulated then, I suspected that that was due to limitations of our ability to test rather than the underlying rates of infection. In fact, we saw a similar pattern around Thanksgiving, where we saw a big dip in the amount of testing. And locally, we saw a decrease in testing that week as well. Well, sure enough, we're back on to pretty much the same trajectory. If you skip over the little dip from last week, 2 weeks ago, we were averaging 347 cases over a 7-day average. Now, 2 weeks later, it's up to 474 cases per day. This is an increase of over 1/3 in the last 2 weeks. But again, these cases that are identified is probably only a relatively small fraction of the total amount of infections that are occurring in the community. Testing is a problem. We can't even really calculate the positivity rate anymore, and not with any kind of recency, because the total number of tests being reported, there apparently is such a lag. If you take the most recent 2 weeks, the positivity rate is actually 74%. And the last week when I did the previous 2 weeks before, it was 37%. Now, I don't think our positivity rate is actually 74%. What this really represents is that labs are so clogged up that they're not getting around to reporting negative tests, which is needed, of course, to calculate the number of total tests until probably days or weeks later. So that lag leads to positives being reported and hardly any other tests being reported. In fact, in the most current week, we had 3,034 positives, yet the health department only reported 3,704 total tests. So that's why I do the two-week thing, to try to get a little closer. Not getting well. That's bad news on all fronts. Our positivity rate is probably really high, although I don't know what it really is. It's way too high. And the number of tests has actually gone down, the average taken the last 2 weeks versus what the previous 2 weeks that are reported last week. So, okay, if you look at total amount of testing done in Ohio, it was stable from like the week before and actually is down from our peak. So we have lost the steady increase in the amount of testing we had for mostly through the summer and into the fall. Good news is it seems like the positivity level at least has leveled off. The previous week it was 15.9%, and the most recent 7-day average was 15.2%. Of course, we really want to see this under 5 to indicate that we're doing enough testing given the amount of infection out in the community. And not surprising, the average number of days for a positive test result to be returned is now 4.4 days, up from 3.6, and most of that lag is from slowing of reporting to the health department. And like I mentioned before, the total number of tests performed is trending down. Okay, nursing homes, we know that's a dangerous part of the epidemic. Well, we did set a new record. Now, we didn't even record this data very early in the epidemic, but certainly since May when they started to require this, this is the new record of 190 residents and staff that have an active case. That's compared to 146 from the previous week and 161 from the week prior to that. And interestingly, the proportion of those people being infected, that's actually 119 residents with an active case and 71 staff. And many times, there's been actually more staff that have been infected than the residents, meaning that staff who are living out in the community are getting infected, but they're being able to keep it, relatively speaking, away from the residents. But seeing this reversal where we have substantially more residents affected than staff means that this high community transmission that's infecting staff is getting to a level where it's penetrating into the residents of long-term care facilities. Now, on the testing front, they also, if you look at the Lucas County positivity rate in long-term care centers or nursing homes, that data was not updated as it usually was. Early this morning is usually when they update it. It was not updated, which I think is bad news because it means that our surveillance system, meaning our data system to be able to follow the pandemic, is being taxed. So, not really good news. Of course, the best news that we have this week, of course, is that vaccines have been approved, they've been shipped out, and they're starting to go into arms. And that's really good. And, of course, nursing homes is going to be the highest priority in Ohio. Not necessarily all states, but Ohio, which I think is the right call there. And then, of course, the healthcare workers working in hospitals with COVID patients is that similar top-tier priority. Okay, well, bad news is the Lucas County death rate is jumping up. From the most recent 14 days, we've had 52 deaths, and that's up from 41 deaths over the previous 14 days that I reported on last week. So this is about a 25% increase in the rate and number of people dying in Lucas County from COVID. And this is above both the state and national death rates. Okay, well, we do have some new data. And being a data geek, I always love that. Now they're releasing data from the Department of Health and Human Services, the federal agency. And you can get this for every hospital in the United States. So I looked at the Lucas County COVID-19 hospitalization and ICU occupancy. And what do we have? Drum roll, please. Our hospitals, patients that were admitted to hospitals, over a third of them, 34%, had COVID. Those in the ICUs in Lucas County, over half, 51%, had COVID. This is the average for the week ending December 11th. This is not that great. That's a lot of people, and of course, it's only going to get worse. Okay, well, let's round out the student reporting here. Now, UT has been out of school, but apparently they're still doing some surveillance. There are people that are living on campus, and they're still doing surveillance testing and such. And they did have 31 positives identified. And from their surveillance testing, they had a 1% positivity rate. That was 8 cases. But they're out of school and won't be back to the beginning of the year or later, depending on what they decide to do. But we're still getting some cases. This is also true with Lucas County schools. Even though they were shut down, by no later than December 4th, we still have a report of 85 staff and 85 students testing positive in the most recent week. Okay, well, let's get to some vaccine-related news. This from The Hill. Operation Warp Speed head says 40 million doses of vaccine will be distributed by end of the month. Moncef Slaoui, the scientific head of Operation Warp Speed, said that the U.S. plans to distribute about 40 million doses of coronavirus vaccine by the end of 2020. All in all, we hope to have immunized 100 million people, which would be the long-term care facility people, the elderly people with comorbidities, the frontline workers, and healthcare workers, he added. We will have immunized about 100 million people by the first quarter of 2021. Asked by host Chris Wallace about that point at which Americans would have herd immunity, Slaoui said, "We need to have immunized about 75 to 80% to reach that point." He added that it is vital that most Americans opt to take the vaccine in the meantime for it to be effective and reach that point. Wallace asked if reluctance to take the vaccine was widespread enough, whether herd immunity would fail to take effect. "Unfortunately, I think it would," Slaoui said. "I think it would be a very unfortunate outcome. Frankly, I'm very concerned by this level of hesitancy, which is not based on any facts or data. The perception that people are thinking that we cut corners or anything like that, I can guarantee you that no such thing has happened." Okay, and in my continuing coverage about how difficult it is to roll out this vaccine, this from Kaiser Health News. "Supply is limited and distribution uncertain as COVID vaccine rolls out. High stakes and big challenges await as the U.S. prepares to roll out vaccines against COVID-19, with frontline healthcare workers and vulnerable nursing home residents recommended as the top priority. On tap is an initial stockpile of vaccines made during the approval process, with federal officials hoping to distribute at least 20 million doses by year's end. While that will go a long way toward reaching the top priority groups, the nation's 21 million healthcare workers and 3 million long-term care residents, there won't be enough to inoculate everyone on day one or even the first week. In Ohio, for example, the governor expects an initial delivery of 98,000 doses, with the state allocating 88,000 of those to long-term care facilities," said Pete Van Runkel, executive director of the Ohio Healthcare Association, which represents long-term care facilities. "It's more than a drop in the bucket, but it's not all that's needed," said Van Runkel, who estimated there are between 150,000 and 175,000 residents and staff members in long-term care centers in the state. "Consequently, the doses will be distributed in waves, with the centers and hospitals not chosen for the first wave getting them in the coming weeks," he said. "Facilities will have to divvy up supplies to best address the needs of patients and employees." "Nursing homes have a slightly different calculation because they have fewer employees than hospitals," said Van Runkel. "It's more of a question of choosing which facilities will get the initial doses," he said. "Once those are chosen, they'll vaccinate everyone who consents, not pick and choose among people." Even so, there may be some selectivity because most nursing home employees are women and many are of childbearing age. Because the vaccines have not yet been tested on pregnant women, those who are pregnant or breastfeeding may not be eligible in the initial rollout. Which long-term facilities get the vaccine first may come down to where they are located in relation to two large pharmacy chains, CVS and Walgreens. In October, the federal government signed an agreement with CVS and Walgreens to store and administer the vaccines. Most long-term care facilities opted to join the partnership. Under the agreement, the pharmacist teams will make at least three trips to each nursing home over a couple of months to administer the vaccines, which must be given in two doses set several weeks apart. Nursing home residents are particularly vulnerable to COVID-19 and account for 40% of all reported deaths. With COVID positive test results on the rise in almost every state, vaccinating nursing home workers is crucial to protecting not only themselves, but also their patients. Okay, and next up from the New York Times, an answer to a question that's a little bit puzzling and sometimes asked. Here's why vaccinated people still need to wear a mask. The new COVID-19 vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna seem to be remarkably good at preventing serious illness, but it's unclear how well they will curb the spread of the coronavirus. That's because the Pfizer and Moderna trials tracked only how many vaccinated people became sick with COVID-19. That leaves open the possibility that some vaccinated people get infected without developing symptoms and could then silently transmit the virus, especially if they come in close contact with others or stop wearing masks. If vaccinated people are silent spreaders of the virus, they may keep it circulating in their communities, putting unvaccinated people at risk. A lot of people are thinking that once they get vaccinated, they're not going to have to wear masks anymore, said Michael Tall, an immunologist at Stanford University. It's really going to be critical for them to know if they have to keep wearing masks because they could still be contagious. In most respiratory infections, including the new coronavirus, the nose is the main port of entry. The virus rapidly multiplies there, jolting the immune system to produce a type of antibodies that are specific to the mucosa, the moist tissue lining the nose, mouth, lungs, and stomach. If the same person is exposed to the virus a second time, those antibodies, as well as immune cells that remember the virus, rapidly shut down the virus in the nose before it gets a chance to take hold elsewhere in the body. The coronavirus vaccines, in contrast, are injected deep into the muscles and stimulate the immune system to produce antibodies. This appears to be enough protection to keep the vaccinated person from getting ill. Some of the antibodies will circulate in the blood to the nasal mucosa and stand guard there, but it's not clear how much of the antibody pool can be mobilized or how quickly. If the answer is not much, then viruses could bloom in the nose and be sneezed or breathed out to infect others. It's a race. It depends whether the virus can replicate faster or the immune system can control it faster, said Marion Pepper, an immunologist at the University of Washington, Seattle. It's really an important question. This is why mucosal vaccines, like the nasal spray flu mist or the oral polio vaccine, are better than intramuscular injections at fending off respiratory viruses, experts say. The next generation of coronavirus vaccines may elicit immunity in the nose and the rest of the respiratory tract where it's needed most. Or people could get an intramuscular injection followed by a mucosal boost that produces protective antibodies in the nose and throat. The coronavirus vaccines have proved to be powerful shields against severe illness, but that is no guarantee of their efficacy in the nose. The lungs, the site of severe symptoms, are much more accessible to the circulating antibodies than the nose or throat, making them easier to safeguard. Preventing severe disease is easiest, preventing mild disease is harder, and preventing all infections is the hardest, said Deepta Bhattacharya, an immunologist at the University of Arizona. If it's 95% effective at preventing symptomatic disease, it's going to be something less than that in preventing all infections, for sure. Still, he and other experts said they were optimistic that the vaccines would suppress the virus enough, even in the nose and throat, to prevent immunized people from spreading it to others. My feeling is that once you develop some sort of immunity to the vaccine, with the vaccine, your ability to get infected will also go down, said Akiko Iwasaka, an immunologist at Yale University. Even if you're infected, the level of virus that you replicate in your nose should be reduced. The vaccine trials have not produced data on how many vaccinated people were infected with the virus but did not have symptoms. Some hints are emerging, however. AstraZeneca, which announced some of its trial results in November, said that volunteers had been testing themselves regularly for the virus and that those results suggest that the vaccine might prevent some infections. Pfizer will test a subset of its trial participants for antibodies against a viral protein called N. Because the vaccines have nothing to do with this protein N, N antibodies would reveal whether the volunteers had become infected with the virus after immunization, said Jerica Pitts, a spokeswoman for the company. Moderna also plans to analyze blood from all its participants and test for N antibodies. It will take several weeks before we can expect to see those results, said Colleen Hussey, a spokeswoman for Moderna. The trials have so far analyzed only blood, but testing for antibodies in mucosa would confirm the antibodies can travel to the nose and mouth. Dr. Tall's team is planning to analyze matched blood and saliva samples from volunteers in the Johnson & Johnson trial to see how the two antibody levels compare. In the meantime, Dr. Bhattacharya said, it was encouraged by recent work showing that people who received an intramuscular flu vaccine had abundant antibodies in the nose. And a study of COVID-19 patients found that antibody levels in saliva and blood were closely matched, suggesting that a strong immune response in the blood would also protect mucosal tissues. Only people who have virus teeming in their nose and throat would be expected to transmit the virus, and the lack of symptoms in immunized people who become infected suggests that the vaccine may have kept the virus levels in check. But some studies have suggested that even people with no symptoms can have high amounts of coronavirus in their nose, noted Dr. Ivan Maldonado, who represents the American Academy of Pediatrics at the meetings of the Federal Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. The first person confirmed to be reinfected with the coronavirus, a 33-year-old man in Hong Kong, also did not have symptoms, but harbored enough virus to infect others. Vaccinated people who have a high viral load but don't have symptoms would actually be, in some ways, even worse spreaders because they may be under a false sense of security, Dr. Maldonado said. Dr. Tall said she was concerned by monkey studies showing that some vaccinated animals did not get ill, but still had virus in their nose. But those monkeys were intentionally exposed to massive amounts of virus and still had less virus than unvaccinated animals, said John Moore, a virologist at the Weill Cornell Medicine in New York. The more you reduce viral load, the less likely that you are transmissible, Dr. Moore said. But all these things are where data trumps theory, and we need the data. So hang on, people, and stay tuned. Okay, well, I want to switch gears here a little bit and look at some of the psychology underpinning our response to this epidemic. This from Scientific American. What motivates COVID rule breakers? We found that fear of financial loss caused by virus containment strategies rather than health risks was often a stronger motivator for abiding by or ignoring government rules. In one particular analysis, we found that not a single country ranked the likelihood of getting infected with COVID-19 as a higher risk than suffering economic consequences stemming from the coronavirus. On average, people around the world are more motivated by their wallets than their health. These findings suggest that a way to motivate more people to follow health guidelines is to appeal to their economic well-being. We also found that political orientation predicted how people would act in the weeks and months that followed the initial outbreak. In the U.S., for instance, conservatives were far more likely to minimize the virus risks and avoid wearing face masks than were liberals, exemplified by the downplaying of COVID-19 by the Trump administration. Although this might not be surprising to observers of American politics, it does illustrate the importance people ascribe to their leadership's views. In many countries experiencing second and third waves, there are people who simply ignore or actively protest against governmental restrictions on their movement. The politicization of COVID-19 suggests that people have other pressing concerns that motivate them to de-emphasize the pandemic. Finally, our data shoot down the commonly held perception that young people are uniquely at fault for the virus's spread. While many officials, particularly in Europe, have blamed the spike in new COVID-19 cases on young people gathering recklessly, this may be a minority. Our findings show that, on average, age is not a reliable indicator of rule flaunting. At the same time, however, younger people do report experiencing a greater impact on their lives and livelihoods than older people. Given this, governments might consider replacing COVID-19 policies that coarsely target entire age groups with strategies that target certain underlying motivations that are common among certain age groups. What can we make of these early findings? A common thread could be what behavioral scientists call psychological resistance, more commonly known as reverse psychology. In 1966, the American psychologist Jack Brehm published a classic theory positing that people believe they have specific behavioral freedoms, and when these freedoms are threatened or eliminated, they become motivated to reassert them. In other words, when somebody tells you to do something, you do the opposite. So strong is this human tendency to resist curbs on personal freedoms that in the 1970s, researchers in Florida testing Brehm's theory found that when a specific laundry detergent was taken off the shelves in one county because of high level of phosphates, which are dangerous to human health, people started to smuggle phosphate detergent from neighboring counties or purchase the product in vast quantities. The same psychological forces that motivate someone to drive hundreds of miles for a banned soap may fit the current pandemic response. Of course, to implement meaningful policies that change public behaviors, governments must command a high degree of public trust to dissuade the breaking of rules. Not surprisingly, we found that stronger trust in one's government to fight COVID-19 was significantly associated with higher willingness to make personal sacrifices to protect vulnerable groups from the coronavirus and its economic consequences. We found the opposite to be true among people who felt aggrieved and disempowered in society. In the current crisis, all it takes is a few people to flaunt the rules to put entire communities at risk for infection. The challenge for policymakers, then, is to figure out how to use behavioral insights to target the most relevant individual and collective motives that could bring the rising caseloads back under control. Our early research points a way forward. To help mitigate financial strains, a key concern of publics around the world, policymakers can do more to support state-run welfare systems and encourage private solidarity. To depoliticize virus control, bipartisan leaders can communicate the long-term economic benefits of virus control. To reduce grievances, there can be a public recognition of essential workers and less blame applied to entire groups. In other words, we recommend a focus on addressing human needs and motivations that could determine whether individuals are willing and able to participate in virus control. Okay, well, we know that this pandemic has been taxing to many people's well-being. So let's do this story from Science Daily. Research provides tools for achieving the how of well-being in daily life. Organizations and communities are looking for practical tools to support mental health amidst this growing crisis, which is taking place alongside ongoing social and racial unrest. In a recently published paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison introduced a new framework for emotional well-being that focuses on specific skills that can be learned. The framework is based on scientific evidence that suggests well-being can be cultivated through practice in daily life. It's really the how of well-being, says Christy Wilson Mendenhall, a scientist at the Center for Healthy Minds at University of Wisconsin-Madison and co-author on the paper. Traditionally, the focus in psychology research has been on treatment of mental illness. We are hoping to broaden the conversation to advocate cultivating well-being at any stage, even when you're relatively healthy. These skills help make us more resilient in moments like we're experiencing now. The framework focuses on four pillars that have been studied in the lab and have been shown to improve with training: awareness or attentiveness to one's environment and internal cues such as bodily sensations, thoughts, and feelings; connection or appreciation, kindness, and compassion; insight, which refers to fostering curiosity and self-knowledge; and purpose, understanding your values and motivations. For instance, awareness, and in particular meta-awareness, that is being aware that you're aware, appears to decrease stress, increase positive emotions, and can be strengthened through mental training practices like meditation. Awareness helps curb some of the harmful effects of distraction, which is shown to impair cognitive function and increase stress-related responses in the body related to inflammation and aging. Another example is a trait like purpose in life, which is a personally meaningful aim that people can apply to daily life. Purpose is associated with positive biological and physical health outcomes. There are qualities of a healthy mind that many people don't even know are trainable, said Cortland Dahl, a research scientist at the center, who is lead author on the paper. We don't think of them as skills. Many of us have thought we are hardwired to be like this or that, but the reality is these qualities are much more trainable and malleable than we think. It's a very empowering view of the human mind. We can learn to be in the driver's seat of our own mind. The new framework provides evidence that people can weather life's ups and downs with resilience, and that the brain and body can change and adapt. Rather than replacing others' views of well-being, researchers say the framework complements other models by focusing specifically on scientific evidence for dimensions of well-being that are trainable and can be learned so that people can flourish. The team hopes to make the science as accessible as possible, and they encourage researchers to incorporate this knowledge into therapy, meditation programs, and other mental health treatments. The work is parallel with what we're learning about human biology. We're just at the beginning of understanding that our biology is also malleable, says Dahl, who is also the chief contemplative officer of Healthy Minds Innovations, the external nonprofit affiliated with the Center for Healthy Minds, which translates science into tools to cultivate and measure well-being. We are not born a certain fixed way. Our brains and nervous systems and biology can be shaped. That's such a hopeful view to have. There are many ways we can influence our minds, brains, and bodies for the better. References to meditation and other well-being interventions is akin to the word sports, says study co-author William James. One size does not fit all. It describes a huge range of pursuits, he says. Different types of meditation do different things for your brain, just as different sports trigger different changes in your body. You can train your mind in different pillars that go beyond mindfulness or even gratitude practices. For instance, the insight pillar, Davison explains, is just about getting curious about your own preconceived thoughts and opinions. Your brain is not set. You can question your own assumptions and biases, and this has tremendous potential to heal the division and othering that we see in today's society. Well, let's make that so. Okay, well, I'd like to shift gears again and end the show in a few articles about nutrition and the availability of food, and specifically food marketing, the impact that it has. So let's start small with this story from Science Daily. Kids gain weight when new convenience stores open nearby. A new study in the Journal of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics found that changes in the food environment around low-income and high ethnic racial minority populations over time impact childhood obesity. Increased availability of small grocery stores selling a selection of healthy items in close proximity to children's homes improves their weight status over time. whereas increased availability of convenience stores selling predominantly unhealthy foods is likely to be detrimental. Stores were classified as small grocery stores if they sold a specific selection of healthy items, such as 5 different types of fruits, 5 different types of vegetables, lower fat milk, and fresher frozen meat. Now, of course, this is kind of intuitive. There's been a lot of research that has shown this correlation, but this is the first prospective study, which is the gold standard of scientific design for this kind of study. And it basically confirms what other research has suggested. So it adds to that evidence base. So a great win for science here. And of course, what's in the environment influences a lot. That's a kind of a standard precept of public health. Okay, well now I want to switch and go big. This is the executive summary from a large report about facing two pandemics, how big food undermined public health in the era of COVID-19. Okay, here we go. Despite growing evidence of the need to adopt healthy diets, the COVID-19 pandemic generated unique opportunity for the food and beverage industry to thrive in low to middle income countries. During the crisis, multinationals such as Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and Nestle, among others, quickly promoted unhealthy, ultra-processed foods and sugary drinks. These companies engage in multiple marketing strategies during the COVID-19 pandemic, appealing to sentiments like nostalgia and comfort as people around the world quarantined at home. Healthy food policy advocates expressed concern about such food industry activities, including coupling solidarity actions with aggressive marketing of junk food and sugary drink brands, which help polish corporate images, or what we would call neutrawashing. You might be familiar with greenwashing. This would be parallel, neutrawashing. Okay, positioning ultra-processed foods and drinks as essential products when they are not healthy foods. Carrying out philanthropic actions while actively lobbying against healthy food policies. And donating ultra-processed food and drinks to vulnerable populations, including to children in school programs and to other low-income populations, contributing to worsening health conditions like obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and exacerbating undernutrition with nutritionally poor foods and beverages. The big food marketing strategies appealed to consumers' vulnerability during the lockdown to promote junk food as an elixir for tough times. Employees, frontline workers, and a public looking for support and hope found an industry promoting their products as a source of comfort. In this challenging moment where disinfection and food safety were top concerns, the industry associated food safety with healthy food. This deceptive message helped to position unhealthy food and drink as safe and vital for household consumption. The industry also enhanced its role as an essential player in the food system by highlighting its commitment to uninterrupted distribution. While corporate social responsibility can benefit communities, the food and beverage industry leveraged the COVID-19 pandemic to create alliances with public entities and civil society, which directly or indirectly advance their own interests. Their responses to the food needs of the most vulnerable populations in developing countries, many still struggling with increased social needs and negative economic impact, was to donate unhealthy packaged foods and sugary drinks. They also donated and promoted baby formula, a breach of the International Code of Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes, because it discourages breastfeeding and affects early childhood nutrition. As COVID-19 spread globally, data emerged that people with obesity and diet-related diseases were more susceptible to complications and death from COVID-19. Countries already fighting an obesity epidemic face the threat of a sicker population and higher rates of mortality. The pandemic also highlighted how policies aimed to create healthier food environments, such as front-of-package warning labels, healthy school food policies, marketing restrictions, and taxes on junk food and sugary drinks, all could have helped consumers to make healthier food choices during this critical time. This report documents how food and beverage industry giants exploited COVID-19 to further an image of themselves as good corporate citizens. It also underscores how weak conflict of interest protocols and the lack of healthy food regulations in some countries left the door open for the industry to undermine advances in healthy food policy. Finally, the report offers recommendations to governments and civil society for protecting the right to adequate healthy food. Governments are called to regulate food assistance programs during emergencies, to guarantee conflict-free policy-making scenarios, and to implement healthy food policies based on international recommendations. Okay, implications and necessary actions. The COVID-19 pandemic created an unprecedented need for global unification and action, particularly to support populations in vulnerable conditions. The food and beverage industry quickly and aggressively mobilized to support relief efforts and promote and donate its products. Public health advocates and experts around the world are rightfully concerned by the sheer size and scope of the food and beverage industry's range of actions during the pandemic. The issue is not that the private sector played a role in helping communities, governments, and organizations during a major health and economic crisis. Indeed, it's commendable to see the humanitarian contributions of those who stepped in to provide funds, operational support, and healthy food to those in need. However, some ongoing industry actions indirectly influence decision-making environments and interfere in public policies intended to protect the public health. In addition, these companies have worked behind the scenes to block food policies, including using COVID-19 as a pretext to delay the implementation of a new front-of-package warning label law in Mexico. While some industry efforts may have been born out of altruism, this report and others from academia and global health organizations underscore these actions' potential to worsen the obesity and diet-related epidemic. The industry sought creative ways to market its products and brand to consumers within the context of the pandemic, and to position itself as a safe way forward in the face of hunger and fear of illness. These aggressive marketing tactics negatively influenced consumer diets and drove some consumers to eat more ultra-processed foods. Food and beverage industry paired their corporate social responsibility activities with large public relations and marketing campaigns to ensure that consumers knew about these good deeds. These NutriWashing efforts presented a clean self-image and distracted consumers from the links between their unhealthy products and obesity, chronic diseases, and death. Most notably, companies deployed manipulative marketing tactics, including deceptive child-directed marketing, taking advantage of the lack of marketing regulations on unhealthy food and drinks in most countries around the world. The need for accessible and trusted information about what is healthy or not has never been greater. Regulations can help governments, companies, humanitarian organizations, and consumers to more easily understand what is healthy or not. Okay, implications of corporate marketing strategies and behaviors. By portraying themselves as a key partner to government, companies were able to favorably shape their image in the public eye, allowing big food brands to share official government social media platforms for public health messages help position these companies as authorities. As these brands stood side by side with ministries of health, and as government officials publicly thanked these companies for their help, the public came to see the food and beverage industry as a legitimate authority on what consumers could do to protect themselves from COVID-19. Assisting governments with financial or in-kind resources, food and beverage companies also affected public perceptions of their legitimacy at the policymaking table, allowing corporate interests to have a say. As a result, food and beverage companies appeared to be part of the solution to the current crisis, and a true partner to government's health policy decisions. This is a clear case of conflict of interest, and has led to private influence trumping evidence in policy decisions. Not that the industry should not be heard and consulted on implementation processes and deadlines as a legal and social actor, they simply should not be defining public health policies. The practices highlighted in this report also undermine the role of the government and can lead to corporate capture, where parties with vested interests in their bottom line gain undue influence, shaping public health policies while further legitimizing the industry's role. Okay, balancing solutions, shaping policies that prioritize public interest. Despite recommendations by the World Health Organization and the Pan American Health Organization, many countries have not adopted comprehensive food policy measures that address the current obesity and diet-related disease epidemics. Governments must fulfill their human rights obligations to guarantee the right to healthy and adequate food, including through judicious regulation of the private sector. In responses to deceptive marketing practices, governments can protect all consumers, but especially children and adolescents, from industry manipulation practices. But without mandatory regulations, the ultra-processed food and beverage corporations have demonstrated willful disregard for human rights standards despite self-regulatory and voluntary schemes. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health recently issued a statement that echoes the urgent need for global action to encourage governments to adopt healthy food policies for all. Notably, the statement also highlights the need to regulate the food and beverage industry to ensure that companies convey accurate information about their products to consumers. Healthy food and nutrition policy solutions can be crafted to address diet-related disease epidemics, but additional policies may be needed to allow such solutions to become a reality. Decision-making processes must be transparent and free of conflicts of interest. The food and beverage industry should not be allowed undue influence in the policymaking process. Okay, well, thank you, folks, for that great in-depth report on the effect of marketing by the food and beverage industry. But now I'd like to drill down a little bit more to really highlight the conflict of interest that we see between missions and actual making functional what they actually do and related to food. And this is from nutritionfacts.org. Hospitals profit on junk food. Why is hospital food so unhealthy? Put in stark terms, cardiovascular disease claims one American life every 39 seconds. And for most heart attack deaths, you just keel over. Sudden cardiac death is the first manifestation of coronary heart disease for the majority of individuals, particularly among women. So for many of these sudden death victims, their first indication of the presence of heart disease was their demise. They don't even know that they had heart disease. That's why an ounce of prevention is worth way more than a pound of cure, because there's no cure for dead. That's why the prevention of sudden cardiac death remains such a major public health challenge, because most people don't even know they're at risk. But we've known for over half a century, when we first started studying autopsying young servicemen who died in the Korean War, that coronary artery disease begins in our youth, even among young children. So business as usual is simply not going to yield the improvements necessary to radically improve the cardiovascular health of the United States. But the good news is a low-risk lifestyle, not smoking, exercising regularly, having a prudent diet, and maintaining a healthy weight, may be able to wipe out the vast majority of risk for sudden cardiac death. So the time is now long overdue to start aggressive preventive cardiovascular disease programs in our schools, our homes, and our work sites. How about starting in our hospitals? A significant percentage of hospitals surveyed had fast food restaurants inside them, with Krispy Kreme topping the list. Brilliant marketing, given that families surveyed in hospitals with McDonald's were twice as likely to think McDonald's was healthy. After all, they let it in a hospital. But what about food served in hospital cafeterias themselves? Are they much better? 384 entrees were analyzed at 14 children's hospitals in California, and only 7% could be classified as healthy. And just in case someone accidentally picked the rare healthy option, 81% of eating venues in children's hospitals made sure to have junky impulse buys like ice cream, cookies, and candy near the checkout register. And 38% had signs that explicitly encouraged unhealthy eating. Why would they do that? If you ask hospital cafeteria managers that exact question, why they don't tend to follow nutrition standards, why nutrition is not a top priority, it's the same answer why unhealthy food is sold anywhere else: the pressure to generate profit. Increased emphasis is being placed on running a hospital food service department as a profit center, a bigger and bigger profit center. It's such a metaphor for a sickness care system in general, where healthy treat the cause approaches are eclipsed by the pills and procedures that bring in the most money. Well, what do you expect from the private sector? But public hospitals don't seem much better. A 2019 analysis of veterans hospitals found that all VA hospitals contain vending machines providing a majority of soda, candy, and junk foods that directly conflict with the, quote, our government's own healthy food choice recommendations, such that, ironically, hospital visits could theoretically promote worse health. This raises the question why any soda or candy machines are available at our VA hospitals. Are we trading the health of our veterans for profits? Maybe it's time to ban junk food on hospital premises. On daily rounds, it is appalling to see patients gorging on potato chips, candy, and soda, the very foods that have been contributed to their admission in the first place. Obscene to see fast food franchises on site legitimizing the acceptability and consumption of such foods in the daily diet. The obesity epidemic represents a public health crisis, but it is a public health scandal that by legitimizing junk food, hospitals have themselves become a risk factor for diet-related disease. Maybe it's time to stop selling sickness in the hospital. What message do residents receive when they are fed pizza and soda pop at grand rounds on obesity? We need a healthcare system with more Hippocrates and less hypocrisy. Well, there you go, folks. You can take that one to the bank.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, Use of Liminal may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Well, that does it for my show today. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com, or you can re-listen to this show, queue up previous shows or future shows at toppun.com/blog/WAKT, or if you want to be notified on Facebook, you can find my Facebook page at Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Like the page and you will be notified as soon as the audio file is available for the show. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.